Welcome to the Roots of Modern America, a weekly podcast on history and how we became who we are. I'm Will Thomas. Thank you for joining us. Today, our subject is William Jennings Bryan, especially his run for the United States Senate in 1894, 2 years before he ran for president at the head of the Democratic Party and the Populist Party. Bryan is a curious figure in American history. He's sort of a person who seems to have had one foot in the 19th century and one foot in the 20th century, one foot in the rural past and one foot in the modern era. Bryan is the subject of a recent biography by Michael Kazin called A Godly Hero. Kazin tries to recover Bryan's reputation as a political figure in American history. Bryan's reputation, after all, has suffered ever since H.L. Mencken, editor of the Baltimore Sun, wrote a devastating obituary of him after his death at the end of the Scopes trial in Dayton, Tennessee, in 1925. Mencken saw Bryan as a bumbling hick, a kind of pre-modern figure, a person grossly out of step with his age. Our question today is why Bryan ran for the Senate in 1894, and what does his campaign tell us about modern American politics? Bryan, of course, was the Democratic nominee for president in 1896, who gave his famous Cross of Gold speech at the Democratic National Convention. It was an electrifying performance. But the roots of that campaign are in Nebraska, 2 years earlier, when Bryan faced John Thurston, the general counsel, the powerful lawyer for the Union Pacific Railroad. It was a barn burner. In 1894, William Jennings Bryan faced the fight of his young political career. He had resigned his seat in the United States House of Representatives to run for the U.S. Senate. But it was a tough year to run for the Senate as a Democrat. There were strikes all over the country. There was a depression that had gripped the country for over a year, rocked it to its core, and dropped it to its knees. There was an unpopular Democratic administration in the White House, Grover Cleveland's. And Bryan faced a strong opponent in John Thurston. But more than that, Bryan faced the fact that in Nebraska there had been decades of Republican control. And United States senators were at that time elected by the legislature. So a Republican legislature would likely elect a Republican senator. Bryan was, in a sense, campaigning to overturn decades of Republican rule and to change the makeup of the legislature in Nebraska. Bryan also ran from an unusual position. He was a newspaper editor, of the Omaha World Herald, and very few newspaper editors had been successful in runs for political office. So in these respects, Bryan had long odds against his success, but he was a dramatic campaigner, a powerful speaker, an orator of great renown, and a young and vigorous candidate. He ran, largely it seems, to lead the Democratic Party in a new direction. The most dramatic events of the 1894 campaign were without question the two joint debates between Bryan and Thurston. This was a senatorial match that many compared to the Lincoln-Douglas debates a half century earlier. Observers saw it as a kind of precursor to the presidential campaign in 1896, just as observers in 1858 saw the Lincoln-Douglas debates as a kind of precursor to the 1860 presidential election. The question in 1894 was what would happen to the Populist Party, this vibrant, energetic protest in the plains and in the South, in the West, that seemed to hold the future of the nation. What party would capture its spirit? What party would emerge with those votes? And would Bryan, the Democrat, emerge as a national figure? So the nation watched the senatorial match in Nebraska with a great deal of interest. The debates proved to be the most compelling and interesting part of the campaign. In Nebraska, 7,000 people showed up for the first debate, and 15,000 swarmed to attend the second. So many people arrived to hear the two men, Brian and Thurston, speak, that the debates had to be moved from a small venue to the state's largest building at the fairgrounds. Both Mrs. Brian and Mrs. Thurston attended the debates as well, and they took prominent seats on the platform while their husbands stood for the hours of debate and oration that these affairs constituted. Brian began the debates with his opening address, not focused on the silver issue or on railroad political corruption or even on the trust problem, but with the idea of a federal income tax, and with his contention in the Democratic Party plank calling on the government to foreclose its loans on the Pacific railroads as soon as they came due. The railroad problem for Brian was linked not so much to political corruption, but to the question of fairness and opportunity for working men. Brian asked, who paid the taxes? And then pointed out that regressive taxation on liquor and tobacco and tariff duties on just about everything made working people pay more for clothes, food, and basic necessities than they should. Meanwhile, Brian implied, without directly accusing or naming Thurston or even the Union Pacific Railroad, that the stockholders in the Pacific Railroads had a privileged position, one that the people, the working men, had bestowed upon them. They therefore had an obligation to the working people. But Brian pointed out that these companies paid out large dividends to the stockholders, to themselves, effectively, and they did not pay back. They claimed to be unable to pay the principal and interest on the loans that the government and the people had extended to them. Because they were overcapitalized and in debt, these railroads charged excessively high rates, Brian said. And it was the average Nebraskan, the average working man, that paid them. As Brian put it, quote, the roads have collected the money and put it down in their own pockets. And we deny the justice of collecting money a second time from the people who have already paid it. So Brian thought that extending these loans would mean only that the people along the line of the road, the everyday man, would be making payments again and again in the higher rates that they paid on just about everything they shipped. This was Brian's forceful appeal to working men and his attempt to inspire them to vote for the Democratic Party. John Thurston, as anyone might expect of an experienced corporate lawyer, did not wilt before the challenge of his opponent, whom he earlier lampooned as Billy Windmill Bryan for his long orations. And in addresses to local Republican nominating committees across the state, Thurston had ridiculed Bryan's move into the newspaper editorial ranks. At one point, Thurston called Bryan a puny, petty, populistic, political pissmire. Now, in the debates, Thurston was much more dignified. His first move was to bring up what Brian left unsaid in his focus on the political issue of the Pacific Railroads and the loans that had been extended to them. And that was that he, Thurston, was, or had been, the general counsel to the largest and most significant Pacific Railroad, the Union Pacific. Thurston turned this back on Brian. Thurston was proud of his work for the Union Pacific. And he claimed that he came across the Missouri River 25 years ago without an acquaintance or a friend, an unknown boy, as he put it. Thurston called himself a self-made man who was selected, as he put it, without any solicitation on my part to stand at the head of the law department of the greatest railway system of the civilized world. Thurston stated plainly for anyone to hear that since becoming a candidate for the Senate, he had left the Union Pacific and did not represent the corporate interests. But Thurston really stood before the voters, before the working men, as an ideal man of the railroad generation. As a man who had searched out and found what he was fit for. And he seemed to be making a direct comparison to Bryan. He seemed to be suggesting that Bryan, aloof from the railroads, unconnected to the great changes of the day, could not understand. Thurston placed himself as part of the wide movement of the times, and he drew great applause with this story of his coming up and his commitment to doing his duty and representing the railroads and being at the forefront of all the great changes of the age. Thurston depicted himself first and foremost as a working man, albeit one who had risen to positions of great opportunity and privilege and power. Thurston took up the direct issue of the Pacific railroads and their mortgages. He considered it astounding that Bryan would even think of letting the railroads off the hook by canceling their loans, and he quickly pointed out just how out of step Bryan was with the conservative members of his own party, the Democratic Party. Bryan, in other words, stood before the voters not only as an advocate of silver coinage and monetary inflation, but also of the repudiation of debts. This was a conceptually broader threat to the Republic, and Thurston jumped all over it. He linked the silver issue and the tariff issue into a defense of working people in a globalized economy, arguing that Bryan essentially misunderstood the great changes of the day all around him. As Thurston put it, every laboring man in this union, whether in the shop, upon the farm, or in the mine, should be protected from the competition of pauper labor of the whole world outside. Thurston just hammered the Democrats for the fall in the price of wheat, for the loss of jobs, for the failure to, quote, take care of American industries. What the American working man wanted, Thurston argued, was work, not free silver. Now, one of the most perceptive summaries of the debates came in Bryan's Omaha World Herald newspaper, and it came from Elia W. Patey. Patey was a journalist and a writer, and she had written a number of travelogues for Rand McNally and several American history texts in the early 1890s. She wrote short stories, she wrote a few novels. She had been commissioned by Bryan to cover the debates and tell readers, quote, how a woman viewed it all. She pointed out that for every 50 men in the audience of 15,000 at the joint debate, there was one woman, but that the women had their own points of view. Patey played on widely accepted Victorian gender differences, and she suggested to her readers that women made political decisions from the heart and not from the brain. Having appealed to the gender conventions of her probably mostly male readers, partly probably to disarm them and draw them in, Patey eventually, as she put it, set joking aside. Patey was also, of course, subverting the very gender norms she was describing. Women readers understood well what she meant by setting jokes aside, such as the very idea that men voted from the head, not the heart. Bryan, for his part, by simply retaining Patey to cover the event, was at the beginning of a long career of dedication to women's equality, women's suffrage, and women's rights. Quote, Mr. Thurston looked secretive, she reported from the smoke-filled chamber. Mr. Bryan, frank. Mr. Thurston was thin with drooping shoulders, Mr. Bryan stalwart with square shoulders suggestive of protection. Mr. Thurston exceedingly intellectual, rather cautious, and full of reservation. Mr. Bryan, essentially candid, very argumentative, and fascinatingly impulsive. She went on to describe Bryan's Jove-like facial features and his, quote, compelling magnetism. Patey cast everything in contrast. Bryan had the dash and fury of youth. Thurston was tempered by experience. Bryan was a prophet. Thurston was an advocate. Bryan spoke truths. Thurston, old platitudes. Patey went so far as to comment on both men's poor taste in fashion, taking them to task for wearing trousers that, quote, bag at the knees. Summing it all up, she gave what might be an enduring portrait when she wrote, "Mr. Thurston is a remarkably clever man and a very adroit one. He is past master of the art of what not to say. Mr. Bryan has a spark of genius, which would make any cause popular which he espoused, and which, if he used it as a sacred thing, for the good of his fellow man and the glory of God, will yet make him one of the great men of the nation." Ironically, John Thurston thought he was the underdog in the 1894 campaign. Despite an almost perfect storm against the Democrats, an unpopular Democratic administration, a depression rocking the country, strikes all over the nation, despite all of these things, Thurston thought that Bryan, fusing the Democrats and the populace, would likely win, and that he would have to conduct a barnstormer of a campaign. Thurston's memory might have been clouded, but his perspective provides a useful lens through which to see this precursor to the 1896 presidential campaign. Historians may have been too quick, perhaps, to excuse William Jennings Bryan for his political losses. Many have suggested that he was just up against long odds, or that powerful forces like the railroads brought him down, or that his crusades were somehow too idealistic for the American voters. At least in 1894, Bryan's campaign was not unreasonable. That he failed, though, should not be surprising. Bryan faced an extraordinarily canny, tough, and dedicated opponent in Thurston, who would campaign hard, just as hard as he did, and who was able to articulate a powerful defense of republicanism for working men. 2 years later, in 1896, John Thurston went on the campaign trail for William McKinley against Bryan in the presidential campaign. He stumped all across the Midwest with his speech, quote, "To the American Working Men." That was the title of it. In attacking Bryan and the silver issue, Thurston used the slogan, "A promise of something for nothing is false and dangerous to the people." Thurston thoroughly dismantled the silver question in his long speeches, but he reserved his emotional energy for his outright dismissal of Bryan. And here's how it goes. "No man who appeals to class prejudice, who incites the populace to tear down those who have succeeded in life, no man who puts sectionalism above nationalism can ever be elected president of the United States." It was an easy accusation to make against Bryan, and its logic proved convincing to tens of thousands of voters. Thurston went on, "Not by tearing down, but by building up, can the common people share in the blessings of American civilization." The Bryan and Thurston campaign in 1894, in a way, signaled the beginning of a modern political era. It pointed to a challenging political problem that elections have hinged on ever since. It was the difficulty of how to confront the very tight relationship of politics and large-scale businesses, or what today we call special interests, in a time when society was, say, mortgaged to those interests. Henry Adams had written of that entire generation between 1865 and 1895 as mortgaged to the railroads, and no one knew it better than that generation itself. The statement applies directly to Bryan's campaign in 1894. For all of his appeal in 1894 and again in 1896, for all of Bryan's vigor, for all of his youth and his oratory, he was not just facing special interests equipped with modern campaign tactics, nor was he simply the voice of a group bypassed in the emergent modern economy and so representative of the end of an era. That wasn't it at all. Bryan's quest was to capture the working man's vote, to realign the Democratic Party, to capture the energy of the populace and realign the Democratic Party as well. To capture the working man's vote, a vote that had for decades aligned itself with the Republican Party, against perhaps even its own interests, its own class interests. Despite that party's leadership and orientation toward big businesses or special interests, this was the challenge. And Bryan, in the strictest terms in 1894 and again in 1896, was not successful. But politics was never the same after it. Thank you for listening to The Roots of Modern America. Join us next time for another chapter in our history of how we became who we are. The Roots of Modern America is produced at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, Nebraska.